Good morning, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DUPACO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. I'm Ken, reading from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, December 2nd. Our first piece from the top of the fold is Area Waterways Deemed Impaired. Evaluations by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources removed more than 30 segments of surface water from a list of those impaired, but changed little in eastern Iowa. The biannual report on the state's water quality is required by federal law. Each state must report on impaired waterways to Congress. In this year's draft report, the Iowa DNR classified 775 segments of surface water in the state as being impaired, down from 831 in 2018. These can be classified as impaired for a host of reasons by failing to meet a variety of standards, but there are some clear frontrunners. You'll see it's dominated by indicator bacteria, E. coli, biological and fish kills, said DNR water monitor Ken Cryer during a press conference Tuesday. That rings true in Clayton, Delaware, Dubuque, Jackson, and Jones counties, too. The area's map of impaired waters looks largely identical to that of 2018. Most of the Turkey River in Clayton County, the entire Maquoketa River in Delaware, Jones, and Jackson counties, and the Catfish Creek system in Dubuque County all are impaired in Category 5 for E. coli levels. Another stretch of Catfish Creek, from its mouth at the Mississippi River to its confluence with the separate South Fork Catfish Creek, has a second impairment as well, stemming from a fish kill in 2014 due to unknown toxicity. There'll be a report of fish kill, but perhaps there was a considerable lag between that report and the investigation, Cryer explained. And they were unable, by water samples or anecdotal data, to determine what caused it. Category 5 means a total maximum daily load plan must be created and implemented to correct the impairment. It does not, though, mean the segment of water is necessarily unsafe for recreation. The impairment of a use does not mean the segment covered by that use is unusable, said DNR Water Monitoring Supervisor Roger Bruner. It doesn't prevent the use of that segment for recreational use. By and large, waters in the state of Iowa are safe to be in, use, fish in, and eat that fish. There is a perception that once a segment is impaired, it is not safe. That is not the case. Cryer said each of these reports tends to read negatively. Based on our methodology, the impaired waters list is always going to have a negative bias, he said. If water is ever construed as impaired or potentially impaired, unless new water quality data, biological data, is collected, that stays impaired. And not every segment of surface water in the state is assessed each cycle. Between 2018 and 2020, 1,300 segments were assessed, down from 1,421 in the two-year period prior. Iowa Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, Democrat, Dubuque, who sits on the House Natural Resources and Agriculture Committees, asked about a Dubuque County segment in particular. Dubuque County just opened Lytle Creek for recreational use, he wrote in the conference's Zoom chat. How and when will that stream be assessed? It turned out that the DNR had assessed Lytle Creek this cycle. It was not classified as being impaired, but the agency noted that not enough data existed to say if recreation was its principal use. What the report does do is give the DNR something to shoot for in terms of addressing water quality needs. And as Bruner said, there are some success stories in the report, including in Dubuque County. A stretch of Hickory Creek, northeast of Dyersville, had been impaired to a Category 5 level due to fish kills caused by animal waste runoff from a nearby farm. This year, the DNR removed it from the list of impaired waterways. We did have some where new data, be it water quality, biological, or fish kill, made it possible to delist, Cryer said. The overall decrease in impaired segments of surface water this cycle was largely due to some big maximum daily load plans and assessments of big stretches of big systems being conducted, especially on the Iowa River. The decrease by no means illustrates an all clear for Iowa water. I would call it stable, Cryer said. Last cycle, from 2016 to 2018, there was a 2% increase, since there was a 2% decrease. The draft report is open for public comment from now until year's end. Our next piece, from the middle of the page, pandemic drives deer hunters outdoors. Interest in deer hunting has increased this year in Wisconsin, according to preliminary figures released by state officials this week. The news comes as a welcome reversal to decades-long waning of the sport's popularity, and many believe the trend is being driven by the COVID-19 pandemic. People are just tired of being inside, so they view this as an opportunity, said Brett Owsley, a wildlife supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. What we've seen during economic downturns, certainly during the pandemic, more people are able to get outside. A healthy, fairly cheap source of protein can be right out their back door. In many parts of Wisconsin, the annual 9-day gun season, which concluded Sunday, is observed religiously, drawing families and friends together for deer drives and Dionysian festivities at cabins and campgrounds. This year, state hunting license sales exceeded 820,000, a 3.5% increase over the nearly 793,000 sold in 2019. Hunters also brought in a larger harvest, bagging in Grant County 4,906 deer, a more than 14% increase. Chuck Cornett, a University of Wisconsin-Platteville professor, hunted with his daughter Cora on his rural Platteville farm. The two were rewarded with 5 kills, including a 13-point buck, one of the largest Cornett has ever harvested. I don't know how many new people joined us in the woods, but I know that for the folks that it is part of their routine, they were certainly looking forward to it with an extra element of wanting to get out and being away from the pandemic a little bit, he said. The move to outdoor activity continues trends observed this spring and summer when the Wisconsin DNR reported record attendance at state parks. After crowding prompted the governor to shut down most properties in April, parks reopened the following month, and weekend attendance on May 16-17 was up more than 44% over the previous year. After camping reopened in mid-June, the percentage grew to 52%. The Iowa DNR has also reported an increase in deer license sales in advance of its deer gun season, which begins Saturday, December 5th through, I think it means December 23rd. The state sold nearly, through November 23rd, the state sold nearly 164,500 licenses compared to 147,000 over the same time frame in 2019. In Joe Davies County, Illinois, Scales Mound resident Jason Diedrich began hunting during bow season in October. Since the pandemic struck, he has fewer distractions and consequently spent more time outside. The corn was out early, so I saw a lot of deer, Diedrich said. He accompanied his 12-year-old son, Will, on the first day of gun season, which began in mid-November. The boy took time off school and joined his father in a double stand where he made his first shot. The weather was actually nice, Diedrich said, especially with this year. It's nice getting outside and doing something fun. During the first gun season, Joe Davies County hunters harvested 1,027 deer, 22 more than 2019. The state of Illinois issues about the same number of hunting licenses each year, with little variation, according to DNR Deputy Director Rachel Torbert. who did not have figures readily available. Growth in hunting enthusiasm is welcome news to states as revenue from licenses and tag sales finances conservation projects, as do the excise taxes collected on firearms and ammunition purchases. Owsley, the DNR supervisor, is intrigued by the possibility that the exposure hunting receives during the pandemic might buoy the sport, attracting new generations of hunters and rekindling passion among those who fell away. Is that something that stays true, or is this a blip on the radar? He said, "We would like to see a trend that's positive." For our third and final front page piece, we have a large center-of-the-page picture of a young lady masked, trying on bridal gown, and another woman holding up the veil. And beneath it, it says, "Owner Sherry Keating assists Allie O'Rourke of Dubuque as she tries on bridal dresses and accessories at Cheryl Ann Bridals and Tuxedos in Dubuque on Tuesday. Engaged couples are looking forward to the new year." And then there's a smaller picture of the same bride, or bride-to-be, O'Rourke tries on a headpiece. Our article is 2021, Year of the Wedding. Despite all of the challenges the year has brought, Allie O'Rourke will always have a reason to be happy when she reflects on 2020. The Dubuque resident got engaged to her fiancé, Adam Gert, in July, and the couple is now planning a wedding for November 2021. The occasion will serve as more than just a monumental moment for the couple. It also represents a small part of what many hope is a roaring comeback for an industry besieged by COVID-19. The pandemic has led to widespread cancellations or postponements of weddings, a trend that has spelled major trouble for wedding venues, photographers, DJs, and bridal boutiques. "We've been in business for 38 years, so we've weathered a few storms in the past," said Sherry Keating, owner of Cheryl Ann Bridals and Tuxedos in Dubuque. "We haven't seen anything like this, though." Despite the difficulties, Keating believes a confluence of factors will lead to a major resurgence in the coming year. On top of the weddings that were planned for 2021 to begin with, Keating said a large number of ceremonies have been rescheduled from this year to the next. Moreover, she believes that the nature of the past year, in which social circles shrunk and couples spent more time together, has convinced more people than usual that they are ready to tie the knot. "I think for many couples, this year has put things into perspective, and they have made the decision to get engaged," Keating said. O'Rourke's summer engagement came about 4 months after COVID-19 began to alter everyday life in the United States. The virus played a major factor as the couple scheduled their wedding date. "We weren't going to have such a long engagement, but we intentionally scheduled it later, so it was hopefully going to be past COVID," she said. "As we hear more news on the vaccine, we're more confident that we'll be able to have everyone that we want to have there." Countless tri-state residents have been unable to proceed with their original plans, however. Dwight Hopfer, general manager at Hotel Julian Dubuque, said more than 50% of wedding receptions planned at the local hotel have been postponed or outright canceled. Others have had to significantly alter the size and scope of their plans. He noted that many couples canceled weddings in the spring or early summer and rescheduled them for later in the year, only to realize that COVID-19 was still a major impediment and that they would have to push the date back even further. "For some of the brides, this is their third time planning their own wedding," Hopfer said, "and there are so many puzzle pieces they have to consider. I feel terrible for them." Hopfer acknowledged that moving into a new year won't be the equivalent of flipping a switch. COVID-19 concerns will certainly linger into the beginning of 2021, but there are indications that activity will pick up as the year continues. Some people are avoiding the first half of 2021, but there's a lot more activity in the second half, Hupfaus said. Some couples are already lining things up for 2022. Keating said she believes the resurrection of the industry will come a bit sooner. She said the volume of weddings is poised to soar beginning in May as rescheduled weddings and those initially planned for the spring of 2021 converge. The increase in weddings could create a shortage of available DJs, photographers, videographers, and other key service providers. O'Rourke and her fiancé are acutely aware of this phenomenon, and they know the rush on service providers will only intensify if weddings in early 2021 are pushed back to later in the year. In mid-August, when we set a date, we knew we had to book the venue and photographer right away, O'Rourke said. Keating said she has tried to keep things in perspective during the pandemic, emphasizing that others in the wedding industry have been hit even harder than bridal boutiques. The venues and photographers and DJs, they are all tied to specific dates, she said. With attire, it is not going to go out of style or disintegrate in a couple of months or years. And like many in the industry, she is confident that pent-up demand will lead to a booming industry in the not-too-distant future. We have a motto since we've been in business that you can't cancel love, she said. Now we have news from Dubuque and the tri-states. 9 more COVID-19 deaths reported. The number of COVID-related deaths in the tri-state area increased by 9 between 5 p.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday. Jones County reported 4 more deaths for a total of 17, and Clayton County reported 3 more, bringing its total to 8. Joe Davies County in Illinois reported 2 additional deaths for a total of 17. Dubuque County reported 48 additional COVID-19 cases from 5 p.m. Monday to 5 p.m. Tuesday, sending the county's total to 9,290. The county's 14-day positivity rate dipped to 16.1%. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered from the number of confirmed cases, there were 3,080 active cases in the county as of 5 p.m. Tuesday, a decrease of 154 from the previous 24-hour period. In addition to the 4 more deaths, Jones County reported 9 more cases, and its 14-day positivity rate was 26.8%, now the 4th highest in the state. An outbreak at the Anamosa State Penitentiary drove up Jones County's numbers. As of Tuesday afternoon, 9 inmates and 7 staff remained active cases. The prison has 5 COVID-related deaths since the outbreak began. Jackson County reported 7 new cases and a 14-day positivity rate of 18.9%. Clayton County had 8 additional cases in addition to the 3 deaths and a positivity rate of 22.6%. Delaware County had 5 more cases and a rate of 18.8%. The State Health Department updated county-level hospitalization data Monday. As of then, Dubuque County had 31 residents with COVID-19 hospitalized, a decline of 2 since the previous update on Saturday. Also hospitalized were 16 infected Jones County residents, up 2. 16 from Clayton County, up 2. 11 from Jackson County, up 2, and 6 from Delaware County, up 1. The state continues to report outbreaks at 14 area long-term care facilities. As of 5 p.m. Tuesday, the case counts were Luther Manor Communities, Dubuque, 83 cases, Shady Rest Care Center, Cascade, 20 cases, Manor Care Health Services of Dubuque, 15 cases, Dubuque Specialty Care, 9 cases, an increase of 2. Hawkeye Care Center, Dubuque, 5 cases. Bethany Home, Dubuque, 5 cases, an increase of 1. Good Neighbor Home, Manchester, 82 cases. Edgewood Convalescent Home, 9 cases. Anamosa Care Center, 65 cases, a decrease of 1. Monticello Nursing and Rehab Center, 66 cases, an increase of 13. Great River Care Center in McGregor, 31 cases, a decrease of 5. Guttenberg Care Center, 40 cases, an increase of 8, and Al-Qaeda Care Center, 9 cases. Stonehill Communities, Dubuque, 5 cases. Iowa's statewide confirmed case count grew by 1,985 for a total of 231,420. The state's related death toll rose by 28 to 2,431. In Wisconsin, Grant County reported 32 additional cases on Monday. Iowa County had 21 more cases. Lafayette County reported 9 additional cases. State officials reported 1,314 total cases so far in Crawford County. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 4,078 new cases Tuesday, pushing the total to 391,313. There were 107 additional related deaths reported, so the state count moved to 3,420. In Illinois, Joe Davies County reported 24 new cases Tuesday, as well as the 2 deaths. Statewide, Illinois reported 12,542 new cases Tuesday, along with 125 additional deaths. That pushed the state's total to 738,846 cases and 12,403 deaths. Our next piece, Stockton Man Pleads Guilty in Fatal Crash. A Stockton man pleaded guilty this week to reckless homicide in a crash that killed an Illinois state trooper. Craig W. Dittmar, 57, will appear for sentencing in February in Stevenson County Circuit Court, where he faces 3 to 14 years imprisonment on the charge, a Class 2 felony. Dittmar also pleaded guilty to operating a commercial motor vehicle while fatigued, causing death. Dittmar was arrested in April 2019 in connection with the March 28, 2019 death of Trooper Brooke Jones Story, 34, a Warren High School graduate. During a traffic stop on US 20 north of Freeport, Jones Story, 34, was inspecting a commercial truck she had pulled over on the highway shoulder. About an hour into her investigation, a semi-tractor trailer driven by Dittmar veered off the roadway at about 12:20 p.m., striking the squad car, the truck, and the trooper. Both Jones Story's vehicle and the semi she pulled over had been stopped legally, and the car's warning lights were flashing when Dittmar's semi approached. But Dittmar did not change lanes to move away from the emergency vehicle as required by law. Court documents from the time of Dittmar's arrest state that he was extremely fatigued at the time of the crash, as to make it unsafe for him to begin or to continue to operate the commercial motor vehicle. Knowing of his state, Dittmar continued to drive without pulling over to rest or take other action, according to the documents. Jones Story's husband, Robert Story, had worked as an Illinois state trooper until his 2018 retirement. He could not be reached for comment Tuesday. Dittmar's sentencing is scheduled for 9 a.m. on February 3rd. And our third piece from the page, West Delaware Considers Facility Improvement Project. From Manchester. West Delaware County Community School District leaders are considering a proposal to spend more than $30 million in the coming year on facility improvements. School board members Tuesday heard from representatives of energy saving and planning company SiteLog IQ, who laid out scenarios for improvement projects that could total $36 million to $39 million. We used all of the information that we have collected over the past year or year and a half with your district and these budgets to pull together scenarios, said Kevin Thuringer, Vice President of Development at SiteLog IQ. Company representatives proposed funding the bulk of the project with a $20 million bond referendum that could be held early next year. The proposal also called for funding $15.2 million in projects with 1 cent sales tax revenue, and $3.5 million with district reserves. If the projects and funding are approved, a majority of the money would be used to replace the district's indoor air quality, lighting and heating, ventilation and air conditioning systems, which ranked as the number one priority for both school leaders and residents in a recent survey. Those renovations would cost upwards of $19 million. Some of our HVAC systems should have lasted 30 years, but they are going on 50, Superintendent Kristen Rickey said. The project that ranked number 2 in the survey was infrastructure improvements in areas such as plumbing, electrical work, and windows, which would cost about $6.8 million. School board members ranked library and science modernization and other classroom renovations as the third most important project, while residents ranked it number 4. Proposed improvements in those areas would cost $6 million. School leaders picked improvements to technical classrooms and music and band rooms as the fourth most important project. That came in fifth for residents. The price tag for those renovations would be about $4.6 million. The fifth choice for school board members was school security and improvements to elementary and middle school bus stop drop-offs, which ranked number 3 for residents. That would cost about $1.5 million. Both residents and school board members picked athletics, including football field turf, new LED lights, and bleachers as number 6. This would cost about $2 million. Board members did not take any votes on the proposals from SiteLog IQ on Tuesday. Ricky said she expects the board to vote on whether to hold the referendum in the coming months. "We won't be taking a vote for a bit," School Board President Ed Poyner said before the meeting. "We've been at this for over 3 years now, looking at needs, talking to the staff as far as their needs, and a task force with the community was established. We are gathering some professional thoughts on how we can approach these needed improvements." Now we turn to our opinion page and our view, the editorial which reflects the consensus of the Telegraph Herald's editorial board. And today's view, Iowa's ag gag law remains unconstitutional. There's a good chance Iowa's ag gag law, which prohibits surreptitious investigations at agricultural facilities, soon could be deemed unconstitutional by a federal judge. That's what happened to similar laws in North Carolina, Kansas, Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. The same thing happened to an ag gag law enacted in Iowa in 2012 under then-Governor Terry Branstad. It took 7 years, but in 2019, a federal judge struck down the law following a challenge brought by several groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa, the Animal League Defense Fund, and the Center for Food Safety. And then, 11 days later, Iowa lawmakers sent a new ag gag measure to a new governor, and within weeks, Kim Reynolds had her own version of the law on the books. The current law, now scheduled for a February trial on its constitutionality, was written with some small differences to the old one, but it raises the same concerns the previous law did in infringing on the First Amendment. Furthermore, if there was any doubt, records now show that the ag gag law has had a chilling effect on the investigations. Iowa Capital Dispatch reported this week that the Animal Legal Defense Fund and People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, two of the plaintiffs suing over the 2019 law, say that in the years leading up to the passage of Iowa's 2012 ag gag law, there were at least 10 undercover investigations at farming and slaughterhouse operations in Iowa. Between 2012 and 2018, there were 0 investigations, they said. "We objected to this legislation going back to 2012 when the Iowa legislature and Branstad made agricultural production facility fraud a crime. Lawmakers proclaimed they were trying to protect the animal production industry from someone who might surreptitiously videotape what goes on inside those facilities. That begs the question, what's going on that farmers need to hide?" The law likely had a chilling effect on whistleblowers reporting unsafe or inhumane practices in animal processing, and on investigative reporting of abuses within the food chain. That's a highly troubling consequence. A law such as Iowa's would have blocked public service efforts of the likes of Upton Sinclair, whose early 20th century book, The Jungle, based on his undercover work, exposed the horribly unsanitary practices of the meatpacking industry of that time. We're living in an era in which massive food contamination outbreaks are regular occurrences. In recent years, we've seen recalls of romaine lettuce, eggs, ground turkey, and other grocery store staples. What sense does it make that Iowa law would allow for secrecy in an area that has a direct impact on the nation's food supply? The court must once again right this legislative wrong. And this time, Iowa lawmakers should let the measure die. Iowans have a high degree of concern about the quality control of the state's food processing facilities. Agricultural facilities should operate with more transparency than other industries, not less. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken. I've been reading from the Wednesday, December 2nd edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Now, we will turn to today's obituaries. Our first obituary, Ellen L. Link. Ellen Lucille Nellie Link, beloved wife, sister, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, was called home November 27th to be reunited with the love of her life, Lyle. Together, they will be with our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. A mass of Christian burial for family will be held at St. Columbkill's Catholic Church on Thursday, December 3rd at 10:30 a.m. A recording of the funeral mass will be posted to the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory's Facebook page immediately following the mass. Please like Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Facebook to view the funeral. A memorial dinner for friends and family will be held at a later date. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Nellie was born December 12, 1930, the daughter of Richard and Lucille Latimer Chapman. Nellie grew up in Dubuque. She went to St. Columbkill's grade school and graduated from St. Columbkill's High School in 1948. While Nellie was in high school, she worked at the Trausch Baking Company, wrapping cupcakes, and the National Butter Company, wrapping butter. After high school, she worked at the Northwestern Bell Telephone Company as a telephone operator. This job enabled Nellie to embark on the trip of a lifetime. She traveled on a Greyhound bus trip across the country to California with her best friend, Lois Link Drexler. The all-inclusive journey cost a whopping $159 and included stops in Denver, Salt Lake City, and Flagstaff. It was because of her friendship with Lois that she met the love of her life, Lyle Link, Lois's cousin, on a blind date. They were married September 12, 1953, in St. Columbkill's Catholic Church. Together, they would create a faith-filled home for their five wonderful children and celebrate 66 years of marriage. She loved her family more than anything and poured her heart into every family gathering, outing, and picnic. She made sure that everyone had enough to eat and would always cater to the likes and dislikes of every family member. You always knew there was going to be a favorite food for everyone. She was always ready with a one-liner and a quick wit that would make everyone laugh. She never wanted to miss a minute of a family gathering. Some of her favorite family getaways were summers at Freddy's Beach at Lake Delhi and the Wisconsin Dells. She especially looked forward to her annual women-only weekends, WOW, with her daughters, which was a tradition of 27 years. After the family was raised, Nellie worked for the Dubuque Community School District lunch program. She loved being outdoors, and this sparked her new passion for golf. She was always up for a round of golf, was a longtime member of Lacoma Golf Course, and even had a hole-in-one. Reverend Lloyd Paul Outerkirk. Reverend Lloyd Paul Outerkirk, age 87, of Dubuque, passed away at 12:48 a.m. Sunday, November 29th, at Stonehill Care Center. To celebrate Father Paul's life, family and friends may visit from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. on Thursday, December 3rd, at St. John the Baptist Church, 241 Piasta Street, Piasta, Iowa. Due to COVID-19 concerns, the number of people inside the building will be limited. All who attend will be required to wear a face covering and are asked to please maintain social distancing practices. To honor Father Paul's life, funeral services will be held immediately following visitation at 11 a.m. on Thursday at St. John the Baptist Church. Burial will be in St. John the Baptist Cemetery in Centralia, Iowa. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is assisting the family. Father Paul was born April 19, 1933, in Dubuque, Iowa, son of Francis Lloyd and Dolores Hilken Outerdurk. Father Paul attended the one-room schoolhouse in Graff, Iowa, and graduated from St. John's High School in Piasta. He then went on to Loras College, working as a Gandy dancer with Chicago Great Western Railroad to pay his tuition, and graduated from St. Bernard Seminary in 1958. He celebrated his 60th year of priesthood in 2019. Father Paul served with several churches in eastern Iowa throughout the years, including Independence, Farley, and Guttenberg. He was also very involved in the Hispanic ministry, serving in Bolivia for 3 years, then in Texas, Marshalltown, Dubuque, and Postville. Father Paul was a member of the Knights of Columbus, Jesus Caritas Prayer Group, Hispanic Ministries, the Catholic Order of Foresters, and Worldwide Marriage Encounter. He was interested in his family history and was very active with the Outerkirk Family Genealogy Association. He made a detailed calendar every year for the family, containing birthdays and anniversaries. When Father Paul took some time for himself, he enjoyed watercolor painting, playing golf, playing board games and card games, and collecting coins and stamps. He had a knack for communicating with children, and they never failed to bring a smile to his face and provide him with a funny story to share with family and friends. No doubt, the world has lost a good and faithful servant today. May he rest in peace and enjoy the rewards of his labor. Memorials will be accepted by the family to be distributed among his favorite charities and may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001, attention Reverend Lloyd Paul Outerkirk family. Elizabeth J. Steinis. Elizabeth J. Betty Steinis, 85 of Dubuque, died Friday, November 27th. To keep friends and family safe during COVID-19 pandemic, private family services will be held. Betty was born February 17, 1935, in Balltown, Iowa, daughter of Clarence and Bertha Yeager Thomas. On April 28, 1953, she married Leroy Steinis at St. Francis Church, Balltown. He preceded her in death on September 8, 2013. Although Betty was primarily a homemaker, she did work at Dubuque Packing Company, in the kitchen at John Deere, and helping others with cooking and cleaning. She loved gardening, especially her rose garden. She enjoyed spending time with her family and grandchildren and making sure all were well fed. She enjoyed having her garage sales and going to them. In lieu of flowers, the family has set up a memorial fund in Betty's memory. Memorials and condolences may be mailed to the family of Betty Steinis, care of Mike Steinis, 300 Oak Court, St. Denis, Iowa, 52071. Catherine A. Thompson. Catherine Kathy Thompson, 88 of Dubuque, passed away November 29th, surrounded by the people she loved. Services will be announced by Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory at a later date. Kathy was born March 5, 1932, in San Francisco, California, to Virginia Jones Thompson and Valentine Thornton. She married John Robert Thompson on Her mother was Thornton. She married John Robert Thompson February 17, 1949. They moved to Dubuque in June 1960. After raising 6 children, she worked for 20 years at Model Wallpaper and Paint Company in downtown Main Street in Dubuque. Later, she worked as a blackjack dealer on the Casino Bell from its commencement in April of 1990, when it became the first American-flagged vessel to offer gambling cruises in the U.S., until it closed. Then she continued her employment at the new Diamond Joe Casino until her retirement in 2004. She was a social butterfly who enjoyed her book club, weekly bridge and euchre games, outings with the Mississippi Valley Hiking Club, and taking mystery tours. She enjoyed volunteering for the Four Mounds Foundation, as well as the Dubuque Old House Enthusiasts, the Bell Tower Theater, and the Dubuque Arboretum and Botanical Gardens. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be forwarded to the Four Mounds Foundation, info@fourmounds.org. Hazel M. Grimm, Platteville. Hazel M. Grimm, 98, of Platteville, died Monday, November 30th. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, December 7th at St. Rose of Lima Church in Cuba City. Burial will be in the church cemetery. A visitation for friends will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Monday at the church. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Dubuque City is assisting the family. Reverend Andrew G. Opadal. Reverend Andrew G. Opadal, 90, of Dubuque, died Thursday, November 26th. A public visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, December 12th, at St. John's Lutheran Church, Dubuque. A private funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family. Ricky J. Hurst. Ricky J. Hurst, 69, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, December 1st. Arrangements are pending with Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque. William R. David. William R. Bill David, 71, of Dubuque, passed away Sunday, November 29th, at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital. Funeral services will be at 6 p.m. Thursday, December 3rd, at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, with Deacon John Stearman officiating. A visitation will be held from 5 to 6 p.m. Please be patient and aware of the limitations on occupancy for the visitation and remember to practice social distancing. The service will be live streamed on the Leonard Funeral Home Facebook page. Bill was born March 10, 1949 in Dubuque, the son of Floyd and Matilda Weber David. He married Jane Reason on June 9, 1990. Bill worked for Boys Auto Salvage for many years and at Clower Manufacturing until retirement. He later worked at Richardson Motors as a courtesy driver. He was a member of the Machinists Union. Bill was a NASCAR and vintage car enthusiast. He was especially proud of his Crosley car that he worked to restore. He also enjoyed camping, traveling, and spending time with his friends and family. He was also an adoptive dad to many of Amy's friends and loved every minute of it. Sergeant Lee H. Andre. Sergeant Lee Harlow Andre, retired, 77, of Dubuque, died Friday, November 27th. Graveside military rites will be accorded noon Friday at Andre Cemetery, Lisbon, Iowa. Lee was born July 19, 1943, in Des Moines, son of Laval and Dorothy Harlow Andre. After graduating from Lincoln High, Des Moines, in 1961, Lee served his country in the U.S. Marine Corps, Naval Seabees, and Army National Guard. He was also a salesman in the loose-leaf binder industry. He was active in the Dubuque Republican Party and Dubuque County Right to Life. More recently, Lee owned Old Massey Station Campground, where he was a permanent fixture. The Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Veterans Freedom Center, Dubuque. Kenneth D. Kaufman, Fenimore. Kenneth D. Kaufman, 83, of Fenimore, died Saturday, November 28th. A private funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, December 4th, at the Larson Family Funeral Home in Fenimore. Burial to follow in the Prairie Cemetery in Fenimore. Larson Family Funeral Home of Fenimore is assisting the family. Donna J. Fishnick, Platteville. Donna J. Fishnick, 79, of Platteville, formerly of Cassville, died Sunday, November 29th. A private family service will be held at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory. Burial will be at the Cassville Cemetery in Cassville. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory of Platteville is assisting the family. Lila E. Weipert, McGregor, Lila Eleanor Schellenhammer Weipert, 89, of McGregor, died Monday, November 30th at Great River Care Center in McGregor. A private mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Mary Catholic Church in McGregor. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of McGregor is assisting the family. Patricia A. Getzinger. Patricia A. Pitts Getzinger, 81, of Fort Myers, Florida, formerly of Dubuque, died Thursday, November 26th. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 5th at Church of the Resurrection of Our Lord, Fort Myers. Fort Myers Memorial Gardens of Fort Myers is assisting the family. Betty Erlaub, Garnavillo. Betty Erlaub, 95, of Garnavillo, died Monday, November 30th. A family service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, December 4th at St. Paul Evangelical Lutheran Church in Garnavillo. Tucky Allen Funeral Home, Garnavillo, is assisting the family. David W. Pont, Guttenberg. David Ray Pont, 84, Guttenberg, died Monday, November 30th. Arrangements are being handled by Tucky Allen Funeral Home, 207 South 1st Street, Guttenberg. Michael P. Kelly, Dyersville. Michael P. Kelly, 67, of Dyersville, died on Tuesday, December 1st. Complete arrangements are pending at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. And with all of the passings of our friends and loved ones, we remember that we very often have new arrivals, and we have one new arrival today in our births. Monday, November 30th, Wilson. Mike and Ashley Wilson of Dyersville, a girl at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital, Dubuque. We continue now with a little bit more of our tri-state news and our news in brief pieces. We have one more article. Court rules Dubuque man to be resentenced in stabbing conviction. An appellate court has ruled that a Dubuque man convicted of stabbing a teen should be resentenced on one of his convictions. Brett A. Gilden, 40, was convicted by a jury in November 2019 in Iowa District Court in Dubuque County of willful injury causing bodily injury, going armed with intent and assault while displaying a dangerous weapon. Gilden stabbed Dustin R. McGonigal, 19, on April 12th during a fight that occurred when Gilden attempted to confront the father of one of McGonigal's friends. McGonigal's injuries included a ruptured colon, according to court documents. The Court of Appeals of Iowa recently ruled that District Court Judge Thomas A. Bitter was unaware of his discretion to reduce a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence if mitigating circumstances exist in Gilden's conviction for willful injury, and because of that discretion was not exercised, a resentencing is mandated, according to court documents filed Monday. At trial, Gilden had argued that he acted in self-defense after he was attacked. Bitter sentenced Gilden in January to a total of 10 years in prison for 3 charges related to the stabbing and revoked Gilden's probation for 4 forgery convictions, imposing a 5-year sentence for each. Gilden's 10 years related to the attack were to be served at the same time as the 20 years for the forgery convictions. At Gilden's sentencing hearing, Bitter noted the willful injury charge amounted to a forcible felony and stated his belief that the imposition of a prison sentence was mandatory, according to documents. The appellate court ruled that Bitter's discretion to reduce the mandatory minimum under Iowa law went unmentioned and was not cited in the sentencing order, according to documents. The appellate court vacated the sentence imposed for willful injury, causing serious injury, and remanded Gilden for resentencing. The appellate court ruled that the district court may leave the sentence imposed as to the other convictions intact, or, if the court determines the entire sentencing scheme should be revised, the court may resentence on all counts. And now we'll continue with our pieces of news in brief. 2 Dubuque businesses face state complaints, 1 fined over alleged COVID-19 requirement violations. Iowa Alcohol Beverages Division, Officials have filed complaints against two Dubuque businesses and fined a third over alleged violations of state COVID-19 mitigation requirements for bars and restaurants. Mason Dixon Saloon reached a settlement with state officials and agreed to a $1,000 fine over an alleged violation of Governor Kim Reynolds' Emergency Public Health Disaster Proclamation. State officials wrote in a press release that the venue allegedly failed to comply with state requirements by failing to ensure at least 6 feet of physical distance between each group or individual dining or drinking alone, failing to limit patrons from congregating together closer than 6 feet, and or failing to ensure that all patrons were seated at a table, booth, or bar while consuming their beverages. The settlement agreement notes that Mason Dixon Saloon did not contest the allegations, but also did not admit to any wrongdoing. The State Alcoholic Beverage Division also filed hearing complaints with First and Main and Main Street Social, both in Dubuque. Officials cited the same provision of the governor's proclamation as they did in the allegations against Mason Dixon Saloon. The business faces civil penalties for the alleged violations, but have a right to a hearing on the matter, according to the press release. Dubuque man sentenced to probation in arson case. A Dubuque man has been sentenced to probation for allegedly starting a fire next to stairs leading to his ex-girlfriend's residence. Timothy E. Scott, 54, recently pleaded guilty in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to making arson threats a felony. The plea to the lesser charge came as part of a plea deal, as Scott originally was charged with first-degree arson. He was sentenced to 5 years of probation. Police responded to 1700 Romberg at about 10:30 a.m. July 3rd. Court documents state that Jessica A. Zertzman, of that address, reported that she smelled smoke while working from home. When Zertzman went outside to investigate, she saw a fire on the sidewalk that was less than 12 inches from a set of wooden stairs and dry grass right next to the house, documents state. She saw Scott walking away. She ran inside, got a bucket of water, and extinguished the fire before it reached the residence. Scott returned to the area, admitted to starting the fire, and then left again, documents state. Police located him later, and he admitted to starting a fire. Documents state that the steps led to the apartment of Susan Breitbach, who had broken up with Scott hours earlier. Unity Point Health names new executives. The nonprofit health system that includes a Dubuque hospital and local clinics named a pair of executive leaders Tuesday. Officials at Unity Point Health announced that Clay Holderman will take over as the organization's new president and CEO in February. Sanjeev Katua was named president and CEO of Unity Point Clinic starting January 5th. Hindeman is currently executive vice president and chief operating officer of Presbyterian Healthcare Services, according to a press release. Sue Thompson will continue serving as Unity Point's interim CEO until Holderman takes his position. Katua currently serves in multiple leadership roles at Edward Elmhurst Health, including executive vice president and chief physician executive. He will take the helm at Unity Point Clinic, a network of physicians, advanced practitioners, and clinics that is part of Unity Point Health. Unity Point's network includes Unity Point Health, Findlay Hospital in Dubuque, and multiple local clinics. Well, this brings us to the end of the Wednesday reading, the Wednesday, December 2nd reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. I'm Ken. It has been a delightful morning of reading for you, and I'll be here the next two mornings with the TH, so I hope you are enjoying what you're hearing from me. You can always contact us with any concerns, questions, ideas, complaints if you have, and we will take them all quite seriously. So until tomorrow morning, stay warm, stay distanced, stay masked up. Take care of your health. You'll hear from me tomorrow. So long.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But, when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.